From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And our connection for this hour was made on Tuesday, June 5th. News came that American fashion designer Kate Spade had died by suicide that day. Just 3 days later, CNN announced that chef and television star and author Anthony Bourdain had also died by suicide. Two huge stars gone in 1 week. Two people who had apparently suffered so much pain. Their deaths coincided with a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which showed a 25% increase in suicide rate from 1999 to 2016. Last year, nearly 45,000 Americans died by suicide. CNN reports that mental health experts are concerned about suicide contagion, which becomes a particular problem following high-profile deaths. In the 4 months following Robin Williams' death, there was a nearly 10% increase in suicides. And we saw so many moving posts on social media this month, people urging their friends and loved ones to reach out if they find themselves in a painful or dark place. But in the New York Times, a columnist says we're also losing sight of family and friends left behind after suicide and placing undue guilt or blame. There is a lot to discuss this hour, and I want to welcome our guests who are joining us in studio. Bill Perrin is a suicide attempt survivor. He's past president of NAMI Rochester, vice president of NAMI NYS, and member of NAMI National Peer Council, and certified peer specialist for the New York Office of Mental Health. Bill, thanks for taking the time to join the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Carrie Andrews is here. Carrie is a survivor of suicide loss in her family. Carrie, thanks for taking the time for the program.
Thanks, Evan.
Dr. Joe Vasile is a psychiatrist and president and CEO of the Greater Rochester Independent Practice Association. Dr. Vasile, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
And Megan Clifford is a clinical social worker, a certified mental health first aid instructor. Megan, welcome to the program to you
Thank
as well.
Thank you for having me.
There's a lot of ground here, and real briefly here, Dr. Vasile, when you've got Kate Spade and an Anthony Bourdain story, two big names, in, especially in American media and American life. What's your concern about contagion and sort of what we might call a copycat effect?
Well, it you know, simply just brings more attention to this issue, and in many ways, it makes suicide potentially an option where people may not have thought it was an option. And if they can identify with the person who has recently committed suicide, it almost normalizes that as something that might be acceptable. So we're always concerned after these very high-profile events. The flip side, though, is it presents an opportunity, much like this show, to be able to have an open and frank conversation about this very serious subject.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to Bill and Carrie about their stories. Different situations, but I think really instructive and important here. And Bill, you're a suicide attempt survivor. That attempt was when?
10 years ago.
10 years ago. And you told me before the hour began that not only were your loved ones around you not responsible for that attempt, but you consider yourself at that moment not even necessarily responsible or out of the control of the attempt. Is that how you would describe it?
That's correct.
Tell me about that.
Well, in the place I was at, I was in so much pain, and my brain had come into such a place that I could not envision a future where anything would get better or where this pain would cease. And the pain was tremendous, both mental and physical. And so then it appears that there are no options except to end my life, which is where I was at that point.
What did you express to those around you?
Well, I was in the middle of being hospitalized multiple times. I had been, I relocated here to Rochester where I grew up from Virginia where I was living so that my parents and my sister could care for me because I was pretty much unfunctional. And I'm sorry, go back. What was your question?
Well, it sounds to me like you at least had loved ones around you who understood that you were in crisis.
Yes, I had great support. And I actually vocalized my suicidal ideation, my thoughts. And that was pretty much why I was in the hospital, in and out, in and out. When I finally started to get better, even a little bit, then my loved ones around me started to relax a little. And it was one of those days when they were gone from the house that I attempted suicide via overdose. And I had sort of hidden it. I sort of stopped talking about the ideation. And
did you do that on purpose?
I think I was just tired of it all. I was so tired and in so much pain that I didn't want to keep going around in circles.
If you had died that day, Do you think your family members, do you worry that they would have been left with the guilt or any sense of blame?
Yes. Yes, I do.
Have they talked about that?
No. No, that has not come up. But I'm sure it has between them, between my parents and my son Ethan's only 12, so I'm not sure where he is in the process.
I think about the people who have written stories, even just about Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain, to say nothing of the thousands of people who die by suicide in this country every year. Even in those high-profile cases, you have people who were friends of these larger-than-life figures saying, I didn't know. How did I miss a sign? I wish I would have known. And you can see, even in their public statements, a feeling of pain or regret. What would you express to anybody in a moment of wonder? Did I miss a sign? Did I not do enough? A feeling of blame.
I would say the feeling of blame is misplaced or unwarranted, that there's no magical sign, one sign, or a list of signs. Well, I mean, there are some that you can look at, but in terms of wondering whether I missed something or not, that's almost impossible to quantify, having missed something, because as someone with a mental illness myself, I can be acting one day, the next, and it's hard to tell whether there are signs.
You were someone who expressed these ideations. You had family members who understood, and yet you still ended up in a position one day where you decided that you were going to make the attempt to die. So you had intervention.
Correct.
Around you. Do you look back now and you know, would there have been a different kind of intervention that would have been more effective to stop you from even making the attempt, Bill?
Not that I can think of. I mean, I was in, I can't emphasize enough, it's the place I was in was, I liken it to the analogy being on a burning raft out at sea with sharks circling. And that's what my life felt like. And every morning when I woke up, I said, damn, I'm still here. And my life was still like that. And I was still in so much pain. And so when that goes on and continues, even in the midst of support and help, at a certain point, I just could not bear it any longer.
And so now I want you to send a message, if you could, to the people who may feel that way now. And here you are 10 years later. You felt like you were in the middle of an ocean in a burning raft surrounded by sharks. There was no way out. But here you are today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, I'm pleased to say. And my message to people would be that there's always a choice, that it's really the illusion that the illness brings to us, that there is no choice, which can be hard to see through. I worked with my therapist for quite a while, and she kept inviting me to entertain the thought that things could change for the better. And I literally could not entertain those thoughts, but it's possible. And now today, after a lot of hard work, I did not go back to work. I used to be an attorney, but my life's pretty much comprised of volunteering with NAMI and some other folks. My life with my 12-year-old son, Ethan, who I love dearly, and been trying to write a book for about 5 or 6 years. Not autobiographical, but...
Okay. So you have a lot going on.
Yeah.
Are you, I mean, I forgive sort of the triteness of this question. Do you consider yourself happy?
I consider myself very happy.
Okay. See, like that's a very powerful message, because you didn't feel 10 years ago that you had a choice.
Right.
And I'm so moved and glad to hear you say all those things, Bill. And I really hope anyone listening who has been there, and so many people have been there, can try to grab onto that, because at moments it doesn't feel like there's a choice. And as we go throughout
Correct.
The hour, we are going to talk about identifying signs, and there's workshops and trainings and we will discuss that. But Bill, before I turn to Carrie for her story, you were, so 10 years ago, you know, you're in this category now, this really growing category of suicide in this country is middle age and getting older white men. And I don't know if you've thought much about that. I mean, you have any special insight about that as a category? I don't know if it's related to economic loss of identity or otherwise.
I'm not sure, except that, you know, my suicide was precipitated by great losses, the loss of a marriage of 21 years, loss of a legal career, loss of the ability to see my son for a while. So it was sort of the trifecta of big losses in your life. And to the extent older men experience great losses in ones or twos or threes, and aren't, I shouldn't say aren't resilient enough, but don't have the tools, haven't picked up the tools yet to deal with that, it can be very overwhelming.
Yeah, I'm reading from Grub Street, had an article on Anthony Bourdain and the silent epidemic of male suicide. Let me go ahead and read from their piece. Older men tend to be more pushed to the margins and seem to be viewed as less relevant, according to Dan Bilsker, a clinical psychologist and University of British Columbia clinical assistant professor. Bilsker says, for instance, if a man in that group loses a job, there's a high probability he won't find another one because he's seen as irrelevant or not getting it. And at present, men account for 80% of all suicides, according to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. While suicide rates have gone down overall, middle-aged white men are still at the greater risk of taking their own lives. That's from a piece in Grub Street reviewing the life and death of Anthony Bourdain. And Megan, what do we make of that? In particular, this sort of a category of loss of identity. Men commit suicide at higher rates, or I should say die by suicide at higher rates. And this loss of identity seems, not always, but sometimes tied to that. What does that instruct in your mind for us to understand?
Well, one of the things I definitely agree with is that...
Get right on that microphone. Go ahead.
One of the things I agree with is that idea of loss and your identity and the experiences that you've had. And with you know, obviously I'm not a white male, but with white male in those age groups, you also see things like declining health, so loss around things like that, you know, perhaps some marriage issues or, you know, empty nest things start happening. So things that they have used to identify themselves. And in our culture, we often have, you know, our stereotypes of how we identify white men and what that means for them. And so as they start to go farther and farther away from what they think they should be, the options seem less and less.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Sure. And Dr. Vasile, what's the lesson you see as we look at this category of suicide?
That you have a group of individuals that often don't have as robust a support network. Mm-hmm. So you look at the loss, the physical loss. Oftentimes there are health conditions. Oftentimes there's issues with substance use as well. And it's a group of people that traditionally have not been able to reach out to others. So the options seem limited. As I, you know, listen to Bill, it's not as if people want to die when they commit suicide. They just don't want to be in pain anymore. Mm-hmm. And when you add into their, you know, sort of the hopeless and the helpless feelings and the, you know, inability to see a different way, it makes suicide an option. And that's what's so very tragic.
Carrie, you lost your father going on close to 5 years now?
Yeah, 4.5 years ago, December of 2013.
And, you know, so he was a little bit older than the category of white males that's the most growing category of suicide in this country, but around there. And part of the reason I think that you and I talked for this program about the need to kind of come out and talk about this is, you know, it took some time for you to process things in a lot of different ways. I'm trying to make sense of it and understand it. Bill had a family that at least understood that there were a lot of warning signs. Not the case in your family, right?
Right. I would say that was not the case for us. And I first want to just thank Bill for sharing his story. I could really hear the pain that he was in 10 years ago come through, and that was just thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
My dad died, and it was a shock to me. It was a shock to my family. He hadn't been suffering in any... I can't say noticeable way, but he hadn't been suffering in a profound, noticeable way where we thought that suicide was something that was imminent or a possibility. So when I learned that had happened, it was a total shock to our whole family. I think after 4.5 years and even more quickly than that, you start looking back at some signs that were there, questioning things that had happened and seeing that, yes, he was in pain, and the same pain that Bill talked about, but it certainly wasn't evident. So it was a total surprise to us.
Is it hard for you to hear conversations about prevention with what you went through?
I wouldn't say it's hard for me. I just think suicide has so many different facets to it. It's difficult in my particular example to look back and think of any sort of intervention or thing that we you know, could have been aware of or should have been more acutely aware of. Not to say that my family and I didn't go through what I think a lot of survivors of suicide loss go through, which is the questioning the what ifs and what could we have done differently and what should we have noticed or what, you know, if there's anything that we could have done to stop this from happening. I think after some time, I know I have, and I believe my family has as well, we drop those questions because they're, you know, I've come to believe that, you know, we did the best we could with the information we had at the time. And there isn't a magic thing that could have changed what happened.
I'm hesitant to offer too many sort of gender generalizations, but I do think this is one that is probably a little more accurate, which is that men don't always emote as much. We don't share as much. And that can be very difficult. I mean, I think about some of the, my own dad. I mean, you got to really pull it out of him if he's, you know, if he's even stubbed his toe and it's hard for him to walk and, you know, he doesn't want to tell you, and let alone suffering physically, suffering with mental health. Have you thought much about that? Do you think back and say, gosh, Dad, I loved you. Couldn't you have talked? You know, can we, you know, do you think about men in general? Is that too broad a generalization, or do you find yourself wishing that he had shared more?
I absolutely wish he had shared more. I think one of the hard things about accepting that he was in that much pain, which I think is the right way to look at it, he was in so much pain that this was the only thing he could see. This was the only thing that he could see. And I think he thought, wrongly, but I think he thought he was a burden on us, and that if he removed himself from our lives, then we would feel free. So, yeah, when I think about I wish he had reached out for help, I wish all of us had recognized that he was really in that much pain. And that's one of the things, too, that I choose to let go of, because living in the world where I'm just questioning consistently what could have been different, or why didn't he reach out to the people who was closest to him? Why didn't he want to share that pain with us in hopes of getting some help? Doesn't really help me move through it, nor does it help anybody else who's lost somebody to suicide move through and continue moving their life forward through the grieving process.
I just hope, as people hear Carrie's words, as people consider, even if you've been in a dark place yourself, any one of us, if you ever have that flash of a thought going through your mind, you know, it will be easier on everyone if I'm gone. It's not easier without your dad, is it?
No, it's not easier at all. I mean, the grief is, I think, such a huge process anyway that probably isn't given enough respect for any sort of loss. But this sort of loss for me, I found to be very jarring. I know my family has, and I believe that's pretty common for other survivors. It's just very jagged. You know, the sudden nature, the no warning. All of the questions of what we could have done or tried to have done or should have done or should have seen. And then holding the very, I think, complex feelings of loving him so much and believing that he loved me and my family, and then missing him and grieving for him, and then also having a lot of feelings of anger and betrayal and how could he do this? How could he do this to us? And trying to reconcile all of that while, you know, going back to work and living my life and trying to be supportive for my family too. It's very hard on the family.
Your father, did he match any of the signs that Bill had talked about, or that the Grub Street piece, that loss of identity, job, physical pain changes at all?
Yeah, my dad, he was 64, and he had smoked he had quit a couple years before then, but smoked for 40 years. He definitely had the effects of being a long-term smoker. He had some heart issues, so he was not in excellent health. He had had a couple of surgeries related to those problems and had retired about 6 months prior to his death. So I believe that part of his issue was feeling a decline in the ability to do things physically that he used to be able to do, and some depression set on from probably not being able to take care of things that he, quote, should, you know, he felt he should have been able to do for the family. And so I think that contributed to a feeling of like we would be better off without him here because we had to take care of him now. Whereas, as I said, he wasn't imminently ill. He wasn't facing any significant illness at that moment that was life-threatening. But I think overall he felt that his life had declined and that he wasn't of value anymore.
And so I think, at least from my standpoint, I think it's important to kind of split the difference and do two different things at once. I mean, I think we have to be able to release people from any guilt or blame that they may feel. I kind of want to say especially in cases like Carrie, you know, there really aren't really obvious overt warnings. and it can be so difficult. Now, we also have to be able to have a conversation on what are some of the more overt warnings and signs. What are the more the dangers and the warning signs that can help us at least identify where there is more of a risk? Some of it does seem to kind of come out of nowhere, and you go, I can't believe this. But sometimes someone is trying to at least reach out for help. And so I think we ought to be able to do both of those things. And in our second half hour, we're going to talk more about some of those signs. But I want to ask Carrie about this piece that I was reading in the Times by Amanda Avutu called Suicide Survivor Guilt. Let me go ahead and read from this and see what Carrie thinks about it. She says, when I woke up Friday to the news that Anthony Bourdain had ended his life on the heels of the news that Kate Spade had ended hers, I felt a tremendous sense of sadness, both because they were gone and because they had been in so much pain. But I cried for their loved ones and friends, who I imagined might be replaying their last interactions, trying to find the sign they had missed, the opportunity they should have taken, the point in the timeline at which they could have saved him, could have rescued her. Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram were exploding with grief and compassion. It is tremendously encouraging to hear the battle cries to destigmatize mental illness, to see strangers sharing their own phone numbers. Call me. If you are ever at that point, call me. But the messages urging people to reach out to help loved ones and strangers carry an unspoken and unintended flip side, that if a person succeeds in ending his life, the people around him might not have been paying enough attention or trying hard enough. And I worry about the effect these messages have on those who have lost someone to suicide, deepening their grief with now an extra layer of guilt, end quote. What do you make of that?
Well, I speak for myself, I probably put enough guilt on myself early on that no one's going to add to it now. So it doesn't really have a lot of personal effect for me. It was important to me to work through this in the way that worked for me, which meant reaching out to help, talking to other people who had lost loved ones to suicide, reading about it, talking with my family about it. My mom was very instrumental in believing that his death was not going to define my dad. His life was going to define him, and this is how he died. And we all believed that, and we all believed that we were going to be closer together and not fight at each other or blame each other for anything. So my family unit is stronger now, and those were all choices that we made to stay connected and show each other how much we love each other moving forward. So, I mean, the guilt, thankfully, I can say it's been 4.5 years, and I put a lot of work into what I call grief work because I think it's important. I think grieving can be transformative, and it's helped me enhance my life and how I choose to live my day-to-day existence while simultaneously missing my father and, of course, wishing he were here every single day.
And before I turn back to the professionals, on the subject of grief, Carrie's in the category, I guess we would call a survivor of suicide loss. You've lost someone. Mm-hmm. You've lost your father. Rochester's not New York City, but there's a significant amount of resources here, and I understand you've been able to kind of take advantage of some of those. But for people in different settings, either of different financial means or people in more rural settings, there aren't always the resources. And I wonder how you see the landscape of helping people who've been in your situation, your mother, families like this.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it really depends on where you live. We're fortunate in Rochester. There is a Survivors of Suicide Loss group here that meets at Lifetime Care every other week. There was an amazing grief writing workshop at that organization as well that wasn't focused right on suicide, but really helped us who chose to go explore all of the feelings that came from grief, which was really an amazing experience, very profound. In smaller areas like where my family grew up, they haven't had as many resources. The survivors group is usually canceled or it dwindled away because there wasn't much available. I mean, there are obviously counselors and therapists to work with as well. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, I reached out to their 800 number early on to learn what I could. And there's a lot online. I think it's an area where we can do more as a community moving forward, but there are certainly in Rochester resources that are available.
And I wish we didn't have a world where people would be in your shoes in the future, but there will be people listening now who will eventually lose someone. And you said, you know, that early on you put so much guilt on yourself that the piece might have had some echoes for you in the earlier days after losing your father, less so now, mm-hmm. Which I think is really healthy. And I'm really glad to hear that for you because I think part of the importance, I think it sounds like it gets a little better is a strange word, but better over time or a little less acutely painful. You have a little bit more sort of a rounded understanding. What would your message be for people who are more freshly in this position or have lost someone or might lose someone in the future?
Yeah, it gets different over time. People say time heals all wounds. I certainly don't believe that's true, but I do believe that time helps. I view grief as a companion. It's with me for the rest of my life. Some days it's right in my face. Thankfully, those days are fewer and fewer as time goes by. Other days it's just like a little thing on my shoulder. I'm like, hey, buddy, here you are. and we have a chat in the morning and that's it. That's how I view it. It's an ongoing recovery process. It certainly, for me, has gotten easier. I can think of my dad and tell a funny story. I can see the beautiful day yesterday and just want to share it with him and not just cry. I can remember lots of good times where in the beginning all of that would just make me cry. So I would say that finding the support and the grief process that works for each individual is key. And using that and relying on friends, you know, at work and outside of work and all over.
Is your first thought of your father generally a positive one or a happy memory now?
I would say 9 times out of 10, it's a positive memory. There are certainly those things that come up that make it pretty hard still. And I can't say it's like sustained happiness all throughout the day. But sure. I know he loved me now. I know he was in pain. I know he didn't intend to hurt us. And I know that... I choose to believe that if he had to do it over again, it would be different.
Okay. And so this is where I think Dr. Vasile and Megan Clifford, who is a clinical social worker and certified mental health first aid instructor, I mean, these stories are so profound. You know, Bill's and Carrie's story, one of a suicide attempt and another of loss. And I find them so profound. And Carrie, you know, saying that if she thinks if he somehow had a chance to do it over again, he might choose differently. And Bill saying, you know, look back at the time, you almost feel like you didn't have a choice. But the message now is that there still somehow deep down is a choice. I mean, Megan, some people who've been through those shoes say they felt like there was no choice. That's it. How does the word choice enter this equation when it comes to a suicide attempt?
Well, I do agree with you that when somebody is at that point where they see no other options, that is, they're not being rational, that they don't have the ability to have that judgment to make those choices, and that is a result of their mental illness. So for me, it's looking at the mental illness as something that's external to them that's happening and dictating what's going on for them. I think it's very important to separate the individual from their mental health concern or illness, their challenge, and be able to help and get interventions to help that person get grounded to understand those options. One of the things I have noticed frequently, and I think it's wonderful, is that often people will say, oh, please call me or reach out or call this number. And one of the things I think is most important when looking at preventing suicide is introducing mental health literacy to people, you know, in general society, so that when they do start to notice things, that they can have that awkward conversation. Instead of saying to somebody, oh, come to me, go to them and say, I've noticed, you know, that you've been isolating yourself. I've noticed, you know, that you're not acting, you know, your normal self. I've noticed, you know, you said you haven't been sleeping, you haven't been eating. You know, I care about you. Is there something going on? And I'd like to be helpful. So rather than putting the onus always on the person who's suffering to come and ask for help, having the education and the literacy to be able to reach out and feel comfortable and even say, you know, be comfortable saying to someone, are you suicidal? Say those words, because many times people say, I don't want to say that because what if they say yes? I don't know what to do.
Or what if I put the thought in their head?
Right. And that is a complete myth. We've dispelled that myth for many years.
That is so hard.
Yep.
Having been there myself to ask the question, it's so hard because you're scared.
Right.
It's very scary.
And that's one of the reasons I know we're going to talk about mental health first aid in a little bit, but that is what we teach you. We teach you a language. We teach you a way to ask those questions, to broach that awkward situation and have the tools and the resources to respond and say, okay, I can help you with this. Here is how I can help you.
Dr. Vasile, how are we going to get more people to at least, and again, it's not just men, but often men, be more comfortable? I mean, are we raising boys who don't share? I mean, is this sort of aside to gender norms? I mean, we can kind of laugh about it. And I mean, in some sense, it's almost absurd. But it can be life and death when people are not sharing and not opening the door at all to let people see what's happening.
Yep. I agree. And before I address that, though, let me talk a little bit about how you might learn to ask about where somebody is at.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, certainly you don't have to say, "Do you feel like killing yourself?" You might say, "Are things so bad that you feel like going to sleep? And would it be better if you just didn't wake up in the morning?" And you can kind of go from there in much softer ways of talking to individuals as well. And I wholeheartedly agree, you never ever would put the thought into somebody's mind. So you can talk about it with your loved ones. The other thing that strikes me is that we haven't really talked a lot about depression. Right now, depression as an illness. And sometimes when I'm with patients, I say, I don't like the term depression, because if I throw that out there, everybody kind of has their own feeling about depressed. Oh, I've been depressed, or I felt bad before.
I've been sad before.
I've been sad before. Which is what they're saying. When we talk about depression or a clinical depression, we're talking about a state that really takes over who you are. It makes you somebody that you're not. It changes your thinking. In ways that unless you've been there, you can't really comprehend what it does to your thinking. And that's where suicide becomes an option. And sure, it's a choice, but when that seems like it's your only choice, then that's your choice. And that's why it's so sad. When I talk about this topic, I always talk about the need to break down the stigma around, you know, mental illness. When I'm even within my own system with healthcare providers and we start talking about psychiatry and behavioral health, I always remind the group that when we talk about that, we're talking about us. We're talking about ourselves, our friends, our family members, our peers, our kids, our neighbors. It affects all of us with the recent suicides. We can see that it affects people with all kinds of means. It affects rich people, poor people, smart people, educated people. It affects everyone. So, you know, the ability to make it okay to talk, okay to reach out to others. And it's a little bit of an uphill battle. This is not, you know, something easy. You mentioned a moment ago that this sort of stoic, male persona is deeply entrenched in our society. And I don't know if we're going to see a mass change. But if a show like this or some openness helps a couple of people, then I think we've done our job.
Well, after our only break of the hour, we'll talk more about adult mental health first aid training and the opportunities you have to learn more about that. You know, I think about what Megan was saying about there's a lot of really well-intentioned, call me, reach out, I'm always there for you. That's not a bad thing. I mean, the more we destigmatize, the more we let people know, no one's going to look down on you. You need a day off work. You need a week off work. Is there something we can do for you? All of that is, I think, important and powerful, but that's different than recognizing a specific sign or asking direct questions that might start to bring more of a change in possible outcomes. So we'll talk more about that. We'll talk about first aid training as well. When we come back here, our guests, as we talk suicide this hour, you just heard Dr. Joe Vasile, who is a psychiatrist and president and CEO of the Greater Rochester Independent Practice Association. Megan Clifford is a clinical social worker and certified mental health first aid instructor. Bill Perrin is past president of NAMI Rochester, vice president of NAMI NYS, and member of the NAMI National Peer Council, and a certified peer specialist for the New York Office of Mental Health, and Carrie Andrews, a survivor of a suicide loss. We're talking about all of those issues and more right here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, police community relations in Rochester. We talked to members of our community who recently met with law enforcement, sitting down to further the exchanges and conversations about how to improve relations on the street. Then in our second hour, Americans seem to develop a fear of singing as we get older. Why are we so self-conscious and how do we change that? Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Listeners had a few questions before we continue on the road we were on here as we talk suicide, but just in terms of resources, you ought to know about NAMI Rochester, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I know, Bill, you've had a history with them. Can I just ask you briefly what they've meant to you?
They meant a lot to me. I remember walking into their office one day and just meeting their executive director, Pat Sine, and she took the time to make me feel welcome. And then eventually, little by little, I ended up taking on more and more roles and ended up as president of the board. That was great. And I'd like to make a plug quickly, and that is when we're talking about teaching people to be open to talk about these things, that NAMI and NAMI Rochester do have a program called Ending the Silence that they're bringing to schools, junior highs, high schools, where they're teaching the kids now about mental illness, what to look for, how to talk about it. So when you start incorporating that at a younger age and giving them tools at a younger age, that should help going forward.
All right, that's important stuff. And namiroc.org, namiroc.org. You want to email them. It's info@namirochester.org. Their phone number, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is a 585 number. It's 423-1593. 423-1593. Also want to let you know that the Real Mind film series, which is ongoing, is going to be showing a new documentary called Suicide, The Ripple Effect. It's the Kevin Hines story at the heart of it. He was on this program, I think, a couple of years ago now, the subject of a lot of media coverage, a New Yorker piece that was remarkable. Kevin is one of, and I'm trying to remember exactly, 20 or 25 survivors of the suicide attempt of jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. And what was, I thought, among the many remarkable things about the Kevin Hines story, I think about what Carrie Andrews said about her dad. And no one knows, but you think if your dad had a chance to do it again, he wouldn't have died by suicide. Kevin Hines said that when he was in the air, he thought, what have I done? That all the things I thought I couldn't fix, all the problems that were too much, give me a shot. Give me a shot. Let me survive this. And he did. And then the story Jumpers by in the New Yorker, it documents some of these cases where people don't have a firearm. They try to die by suicide in a different way and immediately find themselves saying, wait. And so those are stories are stories you can look up. But next week, it's Kevin Hines' documentary called Suicide, The Ripple Effect. That's this coming Tuesday, June 26th, 7 p.m. at the Cinema Theater if you want to see that. Sam emailed the program to ask, or jumped on Twitter to ask, if there is a correlation between white male suicide and firearm availability. Carrie, you were saying, and that's your father's story, you were saying yes.
That's my guess. I'm certainly not, this is not my area of research, but from what I read and understand, that absolutely. I mean, far more suicides that are attempted are completed with firearms than those who are attempted without the use of firearms. And I would assume that would fit that demographic quite well. My father did die by shooting himself, and we were speaking earlier about some of those what if questions that we go back through after we lose someone this way, and certainly one of them is, well, what if we had noticed and removed the guns from the house? You know, would that have made his ending different? Would he have done something else? And we don't know the answer to that question, but this is something in terms of carrying it forward and trying to help other people. When friends or I've come across acquaintances who have expressed concern about the stability of their loved one or their partner, I always ask if there are guns in the house, just to at least bring the topic up. Not, you know, it's a difficult topic to talk about with somebody. But I think that at least, you know, saying perhaps you should explore if there are guns in the house, if you're concerned about the stability of your loved one, you may want to broach the subject of removing them.
Yeah. Bill, your suicide attempt, you said, was overdosed. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And this is not meant to be sort of a progressive political ranting. This is just an observation that what Carrie's saying is objectively true. It's easy to measure. So when you talk about firearms in this country, a lot of the conversation is the likes of what we had last hour. Firearms in schools, what should schools do? Mass shootings, understandably. But a lot of the firearm death in this country is suicide. And suicide completion is easier when there is a firearm. That's a fact. Dr. Vasile, I don't think that's controversial to say, is that?
I don't think it's controversial at all to say. It's very, very straightforward. Most completed suicides, over 50%, are done by firearms. And if you take away the means or the ability to take one's life, suicide rates will go down. It's a myth to think that, you know, people will just find another way. Suicide is often a very impulsive act. And if at the moment the means aren't there, then the event is prevented.
All right. So before I get some of your phone calls and a little bit more of your feedback, I want to talk just a little bit more about when we say first aid training, a lot of people have an image that comes to mind, but Megan Clifford wants you to think about adult mental health first aid training and some opportunities coming up. Tell us about that.
Right. So actually, mental health first aid is very akin to regular first aid or CPR. What it is the support that an individual gives to somebody in emotional distress or experiencing mental health symptoms while they're awaiting professional help or until the crisis resolves. So we're using that model in terms of teaching people, just like if you had somebody who was bleeding, you're going to put a compress on until the EMS gets there. You're going to know what to say. You're going to know what to do until that crisis resolves. So if somebody's, you know, maybe experiencing something that's more minor, that you can talk with them and the crisis resolves, wonderful. If you've noticed different symptoms, which you also learn in the training, a variety of different signs and symptoms that people may be experiencing, you have a toolbox of resources that you're taught on how to respond. And you can say, oh, I heard this, 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 and this. Sounds like that might be depression that you're dealing with. Did you know we have A, B, C, and D? Can I help you get connected with that? And again, Rochester has wonderful resources, but many people don't know how to access them. That's one of the reasons mental health first aid is so important, is because we have them and people don't know how to access them. But in addition, in some of our surrounding counties or in more rural areas, we don't have those resources. So as one of the first aid mental health first aid mottos is, sometimes the first aid is you. You have to be the person that understands those early signs. And I did work with Kevin Hines when he came, you know, the ripple effect. So I like to look at it, understanding early signs of mental illness or emotional challenges and talking to people about destigmatization. It's okay to get help. Here's what I think might be going on. That can cause a ripple effect to making them feel more comfortable for seeking out help throughout their life cycle. We know that people suffer from, 50% of the population will meet criteria for a mental disorder in their lifetime. 20% of people meet that criteria each year, which are shocking statistics. So one of us in this room, you know, are either experiencing that, or we know we are all touched by mental health and emotional distress. So what mental health first aid does is it teaches a 5-step action plan for people to assess, listen, encourage people with resources, and encourage them to seek out professional resources and to use self-help strategies. So at the end of the course, it's a certification that you've received that says, I know how to respond now. It gives a person the confidence, just like regular first aid or CPR, to say, I can intervene until somebody who has the professional experience can, or until their crisis resolves. And we are going to be having 2 mental health first aid trainings coming up in the next month or so. The first one is June 29th from 8 to 5:30. It's at Asbury United Methodist Church. If you're interested in attending that, you can email me, or you can go to my website directly, meganclifford.com. You can register right on that. The second training is July 10th. It is also at Asbury First. And it's the same process. You can go to my website, meganclifford.com. It has additional information on mental health first aid, and you can register through that.
Before I grab Caleb's phone call, again, for people who go through that program, you hope at the end of the day they'll walk out of there. What's the short description? At least better able to recognize signs, have a toolkit to talk about the signs or to intervene?
Absolutely. I know what to look for, mm-hmm. or I've noticed this, and I know how to say, I care about you, I'm concerned, I've noticed, here's my tools. I have this confidence now because I have these tools to offer to this loved one, friend, community member, faith, community, friend, anybody. I've noticed this. How can I be helpful? Here is how I can be helpful to you. So you have a certification just like CPR, just like first aid, saying I have done this intensive 8-hour training and I now have the confidence to be able to help people in need.
Dr. Vasile, I think about some of the differences, the way we treat, I think, mental illness a little differently than we do sort of other illnesses, or even me. So I have a twin brother, and both of us were born with something in our brains that kind of goes a little sideways at times. For me, I get migraines once in a while, and nobody gives me any grief about that. I can, if I told work, you know, tomorrow right before the show, I've got a migraine, well, someone else can host it. Or I find, you know, I turn the lights down in my office, or I might miss a day of work, and or whatever the case may be. I may miss going out with friends, but nobody is giving me a hard time. Whereas my brother for a long time, and I hope not today, but I for a long time felt like, well, I'll take medicine for a little while, but I'm strong enough. I don't need to be on medicine for depression. And yeah, my brother's stronger than I am. I mean, like my brother's this amazing guy who's done all these amazing things in his life. And yet somehow society, occasionally we give this idea that, well, there's a weakness in depression. Or, you know, once you're quote unquote better, you can stop taking the medication. I'll go off it. And it became this conversation. Are you on your meds, et cetera? Well, no one has to ask me if I'm on migraine medication. I get this pass, even though there's something in my brain just like there's something in so many other people's brains. Mm-hmm. Why do we do that differently? And when it comes to that stigmatization of it, what is going to start changing that?
I wish I had a clear answer as to why we treat it differently. These are, you know, diagnosable illnesses. They are consistent throughout the entire world. They're consistent throughout the ages. We can clearly, you know, put them into categories, understand what's going on, predict what's going to happen. They respond to all kinds of different therapies, whether it would be talk therapies, which likely alter the brain chemistry, to medications. They truly are illnesses, they're entities. The challenge is that there's not a test for them right now. And it's not something that you can see, although increasingly we're seeing a lot of really advanced work in that area as we try to understand mental illness. It's sad that there still is the stigma behind it, but talking about it, when people come out and talk about it, it becomes more normal. Even in my career, I've seen dramatically how people are more willing to talk about mental illness now, not enough, but a lot more now than they ever had. We just have to keep pushing on in that regard.
Let me get Caleb's phone call. He's been waiting. Go ahead, Caleb.
Hi. I am a runner, and I feel like that does a lot for my mental state. And I was in sort of afraid of, like, ever being told to, or, you know, suggested or recommended to take drugs. It's interesting to hear what you just had to say, Evan. Because at one point I was dealing with some stuff and went and interviewed a therapist and asked her if she found that I was depressed, would she, I kind of gave that judgment. I said I would rather do something, figure out some way to talk through it, do action, some kind of action to take so that it wouldn't be, you know, that we would decide to go the route of medication. And she said the most profound thing that has stayed with me, and that is that she just said that depression is a normal thing to happen and that there can be a healthy part of it. And I hear what Dr. Vasile was saying and know that there is a clinical depression where you can't move. But the reason it was so profound is that I've always had such a stigma in my mind about that word depression. And I think that's something that, you know, there is a lot of judgment about depression, and I just think maybe it is getting rid of some of the judgment that we have in our society. One of the ways that we can, you know, help people feel better about whatever they can do in order to survive.
Caleb, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, go ahead, Megan.
Yeah, one thing that we've always talked about in the training is when somebody has a child or somebody has a loved one who's come out of a psychiatric hospitalization, nobody's calling and saying, hey, can I bring you dinner? Or, hey, what can I do to be helpful to you? Can I pick up your other son and take them to soccer? We don't do that with mental health issues. If somebody's dealing with something, you know, a surgery, a physical condition or cancer, or, you know, not to minimize the seriousness, but that's part of that stigma. You know, people can't say that no one's going to bring you a casserole when you say I've got depression. No one's going to be there for you in with that kind of a stigma. So that's why it's so important to encourage people to feel more free to normalize seeking support, not just treatment for, but support like for Carrie's family, for all the families who are dealing with loved ones who have mental illnesses, not just people who are in a state where there is possibly a suicide risk, but when their loved ones are suffering, treating it like a physical health illness, that it's just as important to provide support to people as it is for migraines or cancer or anything else.
Sure. And Caleb, you're right. So depression is normal. And to the extent, I thought, again, my own experience, if anyone says, well, I don't want to feel weak, you are strong if you are living with depression. And in some cases, way stronger than I can imagine. So let's continue to erode that stigma. And I want to thank our guests for sharing their expertise. I'll close with an email from a listener named Meg who says, Evan, thank you for this important show. I wanted to share how grateful I am to NAMI Rochester. I'm currently taking a weekly class for families with loved ones with mental illness. It's literally changed my life. I have a daughter who suffers from depression, and I realized so much of how I was approaching her illness was counterproductive to her well-being, my well-being, and my family's. I've learned how to better support my daughter, my family, and myself. The program is critical to anyone who has a loved one living with mental illness. And it says, I can't say how much this program has helped me. That's from Meg. You know, Bill gave a little thumbs up there. I know you feel the same way about NAMI, so.
Yeah, that program's called Family to Family.
Family to Family. You can also have a chance if you jump on meganclifford.com to learn about first aid training, mental health first aid training coming up. A couple of opportunities for that. I want to thank all of our guests for their time, for sharing their stories. Bill, continued good health, and thank you for taking the time to come on the program today.
Thank you.
Carrie Andrews, continued success in your life. And I just admire you so much. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Also, thanks to Dr. Joe Basile, who is President and CEO of the Greater Rochester Independent Practice Association. Dr. Basile, thank you.
Thank you.
And Megan Clifford, if we don't see you at the first aid training, we'll see you again here.
Oh, you will see me.
Thank you for taking the time here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. And we're back with you Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.